The Piano Player of Budapest is a retelling by the singer-songwriter Roxane de Bastian of what happened to her grandfather Stephen, a Hungarian composer and musician. With the help of letters, documents and original audio recordings, along with the piano he played in Hungary during the 1930s, she has written a tale of pre-war success as a musician and then the devastation of the war years, where he endured forced labour and incarceration in a concentration camp. Along with the book, there is a companion album of songs called Songs from the Piano Player of Budapest. Roxane de Bastian joins me now to talk to us about her debut novel and the extraordinary true story behind it. Roxane, you're very welcome to the programme.
Oh, hi, Kay. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, going back to the very beginning, can you tell us a little about how and when you were inspired to write down your grandfather Stephen's story, or when you knew you had enough of your grandfather Stephen's story to progress?
Well, it really all started in grief. I lost my dad, who was also a musician, in 2019, and he taught me how to play piano on this extraordinary instrument that I grew up with, that I knew had been in my family for a long time. So I never got to meet my grandfather, Stephen, but I knew that this piano had belonged to him, and I knew that he'd been a piano player before the war. So with my dad passing, it was, you know, it's now on me to take care of this piano. So that was really the moment where I was intrigued to find out more about my family history, and also to see how much of myself and my dad, if any, I would find in Stephen.
And you found these original audio recordings that your grandfather had recorded. It was recorded back in presumably the 30s, 40s and 50s.
Yes, actually, I've got recordings from him. Well, the majority of them span from post-war, really. So from the 50s through to the 80s, and one or two recordings from pre-war, 1930s. It was incredible. Just going through my dad's things, my sister and I found just boxes and boxes of cassette tapes. So my grandfather couldn't really continue his music career after the war in his elected home of Stratford-upon-Avon in the West Midlands in England. But he never stopped playing. And luckily, he never stopped recording himself either. So it was just magical to discover so much of his compositions, but also just his voice, hearing him and my grandmother sort of potter around in the background. And yeah, it's just really wonderful to have all those recordings.
Then he had a very successful young career as a musician, a very bohemian existence, really, in Budapest.
Yes, he did. So he sat down towards the end of his life to record his war story. And I found it really moving. I knew this recording existed, but I never felt ready to listen to it up until this point. And when I sat down to listen to it, I was prepared for him to, tell me what he'd experienced during the war. But really, he starts off by telling his whole life story before, and his upbringing, and how he came to be a musician, which was really just stubbornness and pure determination and a lot of hard work. But it was just really moving to hear his account, because it was clearly very important for him to share that, you know, what happened, who he was, and what he got up to before the war.
And so, tell us a little bit about that man, that young man, and this talented young man, and what the Hungary of that time and the Europe of that time was, the pre-war years.
So that side of the family were from Budapest originally, a well-to-do family. They had a successful textile business, and my granddad was supposed to take over the textile business, but his real passion was for music. So he was a young, good-looking lad and knew it. And he just had a real passion for Budapest's, at that time, really bustling nightlife. So he'd spent every night out in clubs, restaurants, coffee houses. And there tended to be pianos in these establishments at the time. So he would always steal a minute when the professional pianist wasn't playing to just showcase his work. And that's how he got his first gigs. So he really soaked up all of Budapest's sort of nightlife and networked and mingled. And he describes quite the glitzy life. And yeah, he definitely enjoyed his excesses as well, from booze to romancing to, yeah, music and
The sense of unease starts to develop then in Hungary, doesn't it? Like they start introducing anti-Semitic laws, and your grandfather and your family are Jewish, or of the Jewish tradition. And these anti-Semitic laws were introduced in the late 1930s in an effort to kind of, you know, appease the Germany. How long does it take for this to begin to impact on your grandfather's life?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, too long, really. It was quite excruciating at times to sit and listen to my grandfather tell me the story, because obviously we have the gift of hindsight. And he, as well as, you know, thousands of Hungarian Jews in Hungary, and particularly in Budapest, felt really safe in Hungary. And for him, because of the sense of security, and because he played a lot of music and spent a lot of time in neutral Switzerland as well, he just really was, yeah, in this false sense of security. So he ignores the signs. But I think that's probably a lesson that we can take on for today as well. It's hard to have that perspective to sort of notice the rise in temperature, you know?
Yes, isn't it always the way people, you know, it's so many stories of that war and even these current wars that people often leave it so late because they can't believe in some ways how devastating things are going to be.
Exactly. And there's always the question, well, how bad does it have to get before you uproot and leave your home and everything you know and your loved ones? And Stephen had lots of opportunities and invitations to leave. In fact, at one point, his mother urged him to take one of those invitations and to go to America, but he didn't. He didn't want to leave his family. And yeah, well.
And then he was part of this group of over 1,000 Jewish Hungarians who were conscripted, really, to join this forced labour group. What were they, and how were they sent to the Russian border? Or why were they sent to the Russian border?
Yeah, so again, one of those things, labour services existed, had existed for decades prior, but those existing laws were then moulded to target specific groups, in this case, Jewish communities. So yes, the 1,070 men were all mostly Budapest Jewish elite, doctors, lecturers, spiritual leaders, artists, including musicians. So they were all sent out to the Russian war front to support the Hungarian troops. It was forced labor, and they were really badly treated. And at some point that mission gets abandoned, and all those forced laborers are left to fend for themselves, and essentially left to die as well. And I mean, every Holocaust survival story by definition is kind of, you know, a miraculous story, but Stephen's story in particular just has so many mind-blowing twists and turns. So out of those 1,070, he was just one of eight who made it back.
My goodness, my goodness. Now, as you're talking there, you talk about your grandfather talking to you, and you really translate this kind of conversational feeling you have about him talking to you across the decades into your music. You might introduce The Old Mill Is Dreaming to us, because in that you incorporate the recordings into your music in this companion, and it's one of the songs on the companion record that accompanies the novel.
Yes, thank you. So An Old Mill Is Dreaming is actually the first, and for a long time only, piece of music that I knew of his. And when I heard it the first time, when I unearthed that recording, it made me so emotional, because I think, firstly, so he wrote this piece in the, I think, late 40s or early 50s. And I think it's one of the most autobiographical pieces. It's very dramatic. It's very light and dark. And I think he sort of poured his experience into it. But then at the end, unexpectedly, his voice pops up and he introduces the song himself, saying what it's about, that it's about an old mill that dreams of being young again and tries to keep its wheels spinning, but in the end it could not. And then he wishes my dad a then happy seventh birthday. And it was just such an incredible moment to hear that, because it just made time stand still. And yeah, it just made me very emotional. And it's just an incredible, you know, I feel so lucky to have these recordings that I get to hear my grandfather's voice. And yeah,
well let's
get to know him.
Well, Roxanne, let's listen to that now.
My darling children, the returns of the day. My darling,
your lovely. Oh, it's so wonderful, isn't it? This greeting across the ages. There, your grandfather sending this wonderful greeting to your father, Richard.
Yes, it does make me a little teary every time.
I can imagine. And then you then, as a composer and a singer-songwriter yourself, you took the wonderful stories of your grandfather and you started composing work yourself. We're going to play some of Remember Me Now, which is beautiful. I think very optimistic song. Maybe you talk us into that and just tell us how these very sad stories, but also stories of survival, fed into this song.
Sure. So I was listening to these cassette tapes while I was writing the book. And then at some point I thought, well, this is a wonderful opportunity to shine a light on his music as well as his story. So it brought me so much joy making this album and bringing his music back to life. Remember Me. So this is an extraordinary story, and I don't want to spoil the book too much, but this is a song, well, the original version in Hungarian called Emlék Zelmék. I do not speak Hungarian, but I am trying to learn it on Duolingo. It's very hard. He wrote that song together with a songwriting partner before the war in 1940. It then bizarrely became a nationwide hit in Hungary just after the war, 46, 47, and became the zeitgeist hit because it had this sort of feeling of nostalgia and was about parting ways. So it eerily just sort of fit the mood of the nation. And it must have been so strange for Stephen to have been a prisoner and stripped of all his rights.
Of course.
And then a few months later have this hit. So just a complete 180. So that really inspired me to give that song a new lease of life as well. So this is a new English, reimagined version of
yes,
the song.
Yes, it has all that a nostalgia in it, but it's still got a very modern sensibility as well.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, let's listen to it. This is Remember Me. That's Remember Me from Roxanne de Bastien, who I'm speaking to here about her novel, The Piano Player of Budapest, and the companion CD she has. And again, in that, there is some of the playing of your grandfather, just that you merge in then into your own playing.
Yes, that's right. But we did re-record this piece on his original piano in Berlin to keep that through thread. And
tell us about that piano. Say what you were going to say, Roxanne, please.
Well, to your previous comment about it sounding modern, I just realised that there's a through thread between me and your next interview on the show, the director of the new Blur documentary. So if this recording sounds a little modern, then it may also be because I produced this record together with Simon Tong, who is a brilliant guitarist who has been in Blur and still plays with Damon Albarn. So I just thought I'd throw that in as a little segue to your next interview.
That is a great connection. There's nothing but connections through the time here. As you say, this was a project born from grief for your father. And it's that piano that you talked about is the connection between the three generations, isn't it?
Yes, four generations. It was actually Stephen's mother's piano originally. So my great-grandmother, it was bought for her in 1907 So it's extraordinary that this piano is, yeah, has survived. And it's definitely got a few scratches and battle scars, but it still sounds beautiful.
It does indeed. Well, look at The Piano Player of Budapest by Roxanne de Bastien is published by Robinson. Thank you so much for talking to us, Roxanne.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
To accompany the novel, Roxanne created the 12-track album Stephen de Bastien, Songs from the Piano Player of Budapest, through recordings and recordings of her grandfather's music. The album is available digitally on CD. Roxanne de Bastien will be at the West Cork Literary Festival on Thursday at 6:30 in the Maritime Hotel. The festival continues until Friday, July the 19th. Full details on westcorkliteraryfestival.ie. That's To the End from Blur's Park Life. To the End is also the name of a new documentary that depicts the most recent chapter in the British group's story, captured during the period in which they made a surprise and emotional return with their first record in 8 years, the critically acclaimed number one album, The Ballad of Darren. The documentary follows the unique relationship of the four band members of Blur: Damon Albarn, Graham Coxon, Alex James and Dave Rowntree, as they came together in early 2023 to record new songs ahead of their sold out first ever show at London's Wembley Stadium in July of that year. To the End is an intimate moment in the time with the band, captured by my next guest, filmmaker Toby L. And I'm delighted that Toby joins me now.
Hello, how's it going?
Very good, Toby. I really enjoyed the documentary, which I watched last night. So who approached you to make this documentary, this coming together of the band? And did you stipulate that you wanted it a raw reunion so you could capture everything?
Yeah, well, I mean, firstly, thank you very much for checking it out. Yeah, it was basically, I was tipped off by my production company that the Wembley Stadium shows were going to happen. And for me, it just seemed like a match made in heaven, you know, like Blur, one of the great iconic British bands in the British stadium, you know, which obviously Wembley Stadium is kind of beyond a sports, you know, kind of facility. It is iconic in its magnitude and its cultural influence, you know, everything from obviously Live Aid through to the summer concerts it has mm-hmm. every year. It's just got that absolute incredible energy to it. And so I thought it would be really interesting to not only film the show, because obviously it was going to be a great performance in a great setting, but it was also, hang on a minute, this band are, you know, maybe a sort of a different phase of their lives. They've been in a band for almost 40 years together since they were teenagers. I thought it would be interesting to tell a story about a group of old friends reuniting to undertake their biggest challenge together and their biggest ever shows. And that sort of initial thought process led me to then think about some of the themes that could be possible to cover off, which is about maturing relationships and keeping the spark alive and mortality as well. Honestly, you know, I thought it would be really interesting to explore all of that.
Now, how did they feel about it, given that there had been tensions in the band and that I think you say in the documentary, a lot of them hadn't spoken for about 8 years?
Yeah, well, this is it. I think when I sat down with the band before it was green lit, there was a high pressure but very friendly meeting where it was just the four of them and myself, and we sat down and one of the band's managers just sat down and, yeah, basically brought up the idea of it. And I think from their perspective, they've had some great documentaries made about the band from quite a long time ago. And some of those stories covered off very well the history of the band, you know, the albums and the 90s and how they came to be, etc. I kind of said, well, look, those documents exist out there very well. Let's leave those alone. Let's tell a contemporary story about the here and now. And thankfully, when we went through it, although there were maybe some sort of question marks initially, the more we spoke about it, the more that they got enthused about documenting this period in their lives. And I think also just acknowledging that, you know, who knows if this will ever happen again. And for that reason, you have to be romantic about, you know, ensuring that everything that occurs is there documented, really.
So there's a great scene when they all come together and they all come into Damon's studio, and he wants to play them tracks from his proposed new album. And he has vocalized the tracks. He just wants his band to come together and work with him on the production. And so we'll hear a clip now. We'll hear some of the music and then Damon trying to explain to them what he thinks it's about.
Emotionally, I think with this album, something has been dislodged within the group, within Damon. It seems to be. Well, I suppose it's about loss. It's about the aftershock of loss. Something dramatic has happened, whether it's a breakup or pandemic. I mean, what do you want me to say? Now I live alone, essentially, in the countryside. That's what's happened. And this record is obviously very much feels like that. There's 40 years worth of stuff in this boulder that has been dislodged and now rolls down towards us.
That's a clip from To the End, a film made by Toby L, who is talking to us now. That kind of honesty, that comes very early in the documentary. Where are the four band members now in their lives? You know, Damon there talking about living on his own in the country. There's an ongoing joke about they all have big places, very big houses in the country. There's Graham Coxton, Alex James and David Rowntree. Where do we find them, Toby?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, they're all at different junctures of their lives, as we all invariably are. I think when you start off as a teenager in a band, the beauty of it is the kinship kind of almost falls into itself. You know, whether you're in the same pub together or the same dorm room when you're studying, or whether you're in the rehearsal room together, it's so easy to be in each other's pockets. But as we all discover firsthand in our own unique ways, you know, the splintering occurs inevitably to everyone, you know, whether that's in your late 20s or your early 30s or whatever point of your life. But, you know, that ultimately is an inevitability, but it's ever more complicated when you're in a band. You know, like if your family moves away or your partner moves away, but you're in a band, you know, you're still bound to that almost teenage creative contract you formed with those friends of yours. And, you know, obviously all four of them have got different lives, as they remark upon in the film. You know, they've all got separate families and other musical projects or creative projects. And, you know, Dave obviously recently ran to be an MP. Graham's got another band called The Wave, who are brilliant. Alex has got a festival on his farm that he runs. And obviously Damon is making more art and music than anyone can imagine. He's possibly the most prolific artist of a generation. So obviously in and amongst all of that, even if there is a desire to be in Blur, it's not necessarily the easiest thing to do because they've got so much other stuff going on. So I think the film explores a bit of that, but it also explores, I guess, more deeply a bit, hopefully, as that clip shows, a bit more of an emotional state of where they're at in life, you know, what they feel about the journey they've been on in a band, the journey they've been on with each other, more crucially. And ultimately, maybe some sort of aspersions and allusions as to what may follow.
Now, we know how prolific Damon Albarn is, but like he is a workaholic. They described him, you know, they thought if he got bored with writing a song, he could go off and write an opera or something. I know it's a joke, but I mean, they do mean he just cannot stop writing songs.
It's a fascinating thing. I think the film also shows the work ethic that's required to be in a band. And I really want, hopefully when people watch it, as much as it's hopefully uplifting or funny or sad or a whole amalgam of those things, what I want it to be is also quite insightful about the commitment it takes and the responsibilities that come up in being in a band, you know, of a certain level. It's not just writing songs and, you know, having celebratory nights out. You know, there really is so much work that goes into it, you know, whether it's rehearsing or production rehearsals or touring. And obviously you add to that the complexity of people's busy lives, as I mentioned before, or indeed, you know, the fact that they're, you know, they're still young at heart, but they're, you know, they're maturing, obviously, you know, and there's a lot to take on board. And I think very commendably, the band are quite open about some of that vulnerability as the film goes on, you know, explaining the ups and downs physically and mentally and emotionally that come with the territory, if you will.
And do you think that Damon Albarn is like living a quite lonely existence in the country?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I mean, obviously, that would be for him to say. I think he's able to keep himself obviously very occupied with his projects. And obviously, he's performing so much and making so much art. So I don't think I would ever call him lonely. But I think the nature of any artist, regardless of Damon, is that, you know, you've got to be quite insular, because on the one hand, you're observing the world around you and you're commenting on it. But then on the other hand, you have to sort of bury a way to write about it and then to record it. So I think innately the role of any artist, whether you're well known or not well known, I think there's a lot of private time that comes with that in order to create and produce. And I guess the reward for that, you know, introverted headspace is to then become extrovert by performing and then talking to people about the work you do. So in that way, I think I don't think it's accurate to say he's lonely, but I think the nature of being an artist is an insular task. And at times I can imagine that you could spend days probably not with seeing anyone, you know, but depending on the personality type, that might suit someone pretty well.
The album is in the can, and then they decide that they go on tour. And of course, it does begin to reveal itself that it's like all those bands, it's four guys being together that's often the problem, and that had been the problem in the past. So they're going off again, working together and touring the world, well, touring small venues in Britain and then touring more extensively.
Yeah, I think I don't know about you, but I think it's interesting because I felt like the dynamics with them were always, there was always good laughter. The amount of humour in Blur, I think, is probably under documented. And I hope this film goes some way to addressing that balance a bit more, because I think sometimes quite wisely, because they are such a progressive, artful band, I think sometimes people construe them as pretty serious and earnest. But hopefully this film dispels that perception. But yeah, I don't know about you. I mean, even if I had the blessing of hanging out with three of my closest friends for a week or a two or a few at a time, going on the road up and down, I as much as that would be glorious, I'd imagine there'd be some really frustrating moments, you know, people wanting to do different things, or maybe someone being more tired than the other person and being a bit more irritable. I think those things just come with the territory. And again, back to my earlier comment of when you form a band in your teenage years and then you've grown into fully fledged adults, like, you've kind of got this teenage dream that's followed you all the way through into adulthood. And I think that there's a lot of complexity that comes with that exciting opportunity, but then also the weight that comes with that. But regardless of any tensions, which, again, you know, I commend the band for allowing those to be viewed in real time in the film, hopefully what comes across overall is an essence of true camaraderie and the spirit of really good old friendship.
A very light moment is the introduction of Phil Daniels into your plot. Tell us about the importance of him in the track Park Life.
Well, I think what's interesting about Phil is that he's not been part of one iconic moment in the form of Park Life. But obviously, the reason that he ended up on the song was because, you know, Damon and Graham in particular, but the rest of the band, were huge fans of Quadrophenia, which is obviously an iconic film. Mm-hmm. And not least breaking through for Phil Daniels, but also Sting as an actor at the time. I think they were just thought, wouldn't it be amazing if we got the archetypal mod, you know, sort of person on this song? And, you know, in that process, I was familiar with the story to an extent, but I thought it'd be really nice to actually tell that story for the viewer in this documentary, especially given that Park Life is 30 years old this year. It felt like a bit of a sort of natural opportunity, because he popped up in Eastbourne in one of the warm-up shows as a surprise guest, and then he pops up again at Wembley. So it was really lovely to sort of allow him to tell his side of the events of how that came to be. And the long and short of it was, is he was on a football team with the editor of the New Musical Express, NME, which obviously was the iconic weekly publication, but is now the online massive music website. And he was just having a kickabout with the editor of NME, who said, you know, there's this hot young band that they're looking to work with you. And he wasn't sure. You know, he's an actor. He's not a singer. But nonetheless, the trajectory in Star of Blur was rising fast. And I think he was like, actually, you know what, I should do this. And what's interesting about it is that originally Damon was going to verbalize those iconic verse lines on that song, but he just couldn't get into the character. So it really did need an iconic actor like Phil Daniels to step up and deliver those now immortal verses of Parklife.
Let's listen to that now. There we go, Parklife, From to the End, a new documentary by Toby L. Toby, thank you so much for talking to us.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
That is Blur to the End. It's a feature-length documentary directed by Toby L, which will be screened at cinemas in the UK and Ireland from the 19th of July. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. Well, we're just back from the Galway Film Fla, where we were thrilled to host a public interview with the actor Brian Cox to a sold-out audience in the Galmont Hotel yesterday. During a lively conversation, Brian discussed his childhood in Dundee, his early introduction to acting, his move to Hollywood in the 1990s, and some of his iconic roles in films like Manhunter, Braveheart, Churchill, and the Bourne franchise. He also talked in detail about the part that made him a global star and took away his anonymity. Logan Roy, CEO of Waystar Royco and the brash patriarch of the Roy family in his HBO's Succession series. Here's a short clip of Brian explaining why he believes Logan Roy cannot be media mogul Rupert Murdoch.
This is why it's not Rupert Murdoch, and it's not, you know, everybody said it's about Rupert Murdoch. Well, it isn't, because Rupert Murdoch already inherited something. Logan is a self-made man, really self-made man. I also think that Logan was a sort of, I mean, you know, they always say that a cynic is a destroyed romantic, and I think Logan had that romantic element about him when he was young that was kind of brutalized out of him, and he became the man that we see, you know, and that was my journey on the part, you know. So I kept saying, I don't want anything that says that he had any form of privilege, and he doesn't. He has a sister who died, who had polio, and he may have infected her. There's all of that which we don't see. And then we have a scene where he's swimming and he's got scars on his back. And we don't explain it. We just say, so it's up to the audience to take that, you know. And this is what I also, where I go back to the American actors, is let the audience make decisions. Don't make decisions on their behalf. Just present what you have to present. And the audience will, that's what's great about being an audience, because you think, oh, he's going to go this. Oh, he didn't. He went that way. Oh, that's good, because he's going to go. Oh, no, he's going to go that. You know, that's what's great about it. And if you're second guessing that as the actor or the director or the writer, you're not doing the job, you know.
Brian Cox there at Arena's public event at the Galway Film Fla in association with IFTA that happened yesterday. And we're delighted to broadcast that wonderful event right here on Arena this Wednesday night at 7 p.m. One of the lovely things about summer months is open-air evening events. Now, that might not seem very promising this damp day, but hope springs eternal, and let's fast forward to early August and picture a balmy evening at the lovely Loch Crew Estate in Oldcastle in County Meath on Saturday the 10th of August, where we're promised luscious sounds alongside idyllic vistas, tranquil gardenscapes, picnic baskets and delightful atmosphere at the Loch Crew Opera Gala. Soprano Sandra Oman is here, and she's one of the four performers for what promises to be a magical evening. Oh, I'm there with my picnic basket, Sandra.
Tell us
what it's like. What is Loch Crew like, first of all?
Loch Crew is the most stunning estate owned by lovely Emily Napier, and it has had a long association with opera and the presentation of opera. I remember 15 years ago, I can be very specific because I was pregnant with my daughter Emily at the time. I went to see, I think it was the first time that they present opera. They presented opera at the Loch Crew Opera Festival. It was a Lab OM. And it's a very glamorous event, and it promises to be the same again this year. There is a dining facility. You can book dinner in the interval of the performance at the Lime Cafe.
Because there's 90 minutes of an interval.
There is. It's a little bit like the model in Glyndebourne or Loughborough Festival Opera. When I performed there, we used to have a 90-minute interval while the patrons could go and have dinner or have...
Well, we're not here to discuss the dinner because we're more high-minded than that, though I'd love to know what the dinner is. What is the music programme for the evening?
Well, the musical menu is, for the first half of the programme, predominantly dedicated to Puccini, given that we are in the centenary year of the composer.
Yes, Ireland has gone Puccini mad. We had Gavin Ring in
and
Rory Don, they're doing La Bohème in Carras Iveen.
Yes, they
are. Now you're celebrating him in Loch Crew.
Absolutely. Well, Puccini is, I suppose the best way to describe him is the Andrew Lloyd Webber of his day. Hugely popular, a genius of orchestration. He's close to my own heart because I'm almost finished actually my PhD on Puccini, on his first opera, Manolesco. And as I said, who doesn't love a bit of Puccini? So we're going to be singing things from Tosca, from La Bohème, of course, from Madame Butterfly and Gian Niskicki, you name it. Any of the great Puccini potboilers that you can think of, we will include in the first half.
And that is what we're going to hear you singing now from Janiski,
that's correct.
That's O Mio Bambino Caro. And this is such a famous aria.
It's such a famous aria. It's an aria that my dad, God rest his soul, always used to say, sing the one to me about your daddy. And it's a girl basically begging her father to allow her to get engaged.
Sandra Mann there on singing O Mio Bambino Cara, Puccini's, of course. And that's from your album Liberty.
That's right. Yeah,
and that's because you're a girl from the Liberties.
It is indeed, yes. That's where the title came from.
And that was a huge selling album, wasn't it?
It did very well, thank God, at the time. Yeah, it went into the iTunes vocal charts, was number one there, and it even went into the pop charts briefly, very briefly, to number four, actually, which was incredible at the time.
And have you plans for another album?
I did a follow-up album, a Christmas album after that, and it did very well as well. It's similar, to be honest. So, no, at the moment I don't. Right now it's getting over the line with the PhD, as you can imagine. Yeah. It's
and
a struggle.
Tell me, it's his first opera you've written the PhD on, and what aspect of it?
His first successful opera, I'll say to that. The first one that people think and associate. He had two before that. But yes, what is it? I'm focusing on the preparation and execution of the lead role. So I've basically been interviewing the greatest interpreters of the role from around the world. I've been very lucky that so many of them have agreed to speak to me. People from Christine Opolais to Adina Nitescu to Elizabeth Llewellyn to then the divas of the last 30 years, Nelly Mirachoiu, Dame Rosalind Plowright.
Fascinating for a soprano to be able to talk to all these other sopranos.
Wonderful.
About interpretation. What gems did you learn from them?
Oh gosh, so many wonderful things. Things like how pacing is crucial and how you learn pacing through rehearsal. You have to sing out at most of your rehearsals because you can't learn where to hold back, where you can, you know. And really, ultimately, the place you learn opera is on the stage on opening night. You really only know when you are dealing with nerves as well as the role.
And did you find different interpretations from the different opera singers?
Very much so. And it's also dependent on the concept of the director designer, and so you can have traditional productions. I've also been, another aspect of my PhD is that I've been travelling to productions of Manon Lescaut around the world, and my goodness me, there are many ways to skin a cat, as the fella says. You know, traditional productions, highly avant-garde productions, highly avant-garde.
And it sounds like you didn't like them very highly avant-garde.
There was only one that I found very jarring, but the rest were magnificent.
Why was it jarring?
Yeah. Why?
Yeah.
Ash was set in a swimming pool, you know, and they had water coolers everywhere, and then people were dressed up as animals. And, you know, you spent the time trying to decode the mysteries rather than focusing on the central relationship and having any form of empathy with the heroine, you know. So that's the problem.
I'm glad you were doing your PhD for them. That's your work with the critic on the night. But well, very good. Now, let's get back to Locke Crewe.
Yes,
because
yes.
As well as solo, you're also doing a duet.
I am. I'm singing a duet with the lovely Sylvia O'Brien, a longtime colleague of mine, another soprano. We're singing the Barcarolle from Offenbach's The Tales of Hoffmann, and it's a real favourite.
And this is Belle Nuit.
Nuit d'amour.
And now we don't have you and Sylvia singing this, but we have Joan Sutherland and Huguette Tourangeau. Are there both sopranos, or is there mezzo, or what is there?
Yes, it's a soprano and a mezzo-soprano duet, but I mean, it's neither part sits very high or very low in the voice, so it's easily sung by two sopranos, and very frequently is. So it's a beautiful duet.
And you and Sylvia?
Myself and Sylvia.
Are you both sopranos?
We are both sopranos, yes we are indeed.
Oh, yeah. Going back to Locke Crewe, so you said there's this long interval.
Yes.
And then also the programme kind of flips in the second half. Is that right?
It does. Hopefully people will be sated after their meal or their picnic and they'll be feeling mellow. And so they'll come back to a lighter second half. It will be more the classics of musical theatre. And when I say classics, I'm talking about the golden age of musicals. Rodgers and Hammerstein, Lerner and Lowe, Michel Legrand, that type of thing. So we'll be singing excerpts from Oklahoma. Of course, a couple of numbers there. I'll be singing a song from The Umbrellas of Cherbourg as well. And we'll have other musical treats from, let's say, My Fair Lady from Gavin. Our tenor is Andrew Gavin. And our baritone is Brendan Collins. And we have the wonderful David Ray on piano as well. So that's the lineup of musicians there.
And now we heard that lovely recording of You, O Mio Bambino Caro, and that was obviously recorded in a studio.
Yes, it was.
Well, how different is it then singing in the open air?
Oh, gosh. Well, that's really not like with like. Studio conditions are difficult in their own way. It's difficult to bring the live performance aspect into a studio. But open air is exponentially more difficult. You're fighting the elements. You've no natural acoustic. That's the main problem. So it's generally speaking, it's amplified. And unless you have really decent fold back for the singers, you can't hear yourself, you know. So the tendency will be to push. So you have to resist that tendency and trust that the sound is travelling. You know, so
right. That is quite scary.
Yes, and unfortunately, I have a lot of experience of it because I've been involved in the Opera in the Open Dublin City Council project since 2 years into its inauguration. So I'm with it now. I think 23 years. It's enjoying its 25th anniversary.
So you must have really cracked how to do it.
I hope so. You learn. We're constantly learning, and yeah. I hope so at this point.
Yes. So we've a third piece. This is yes. Un bel di vedremo. Is that right?
Yes, it is.
And we have Maria Callas singing. This is from Madame Butterfly.
Yes, it is. And I'll be singing this on the night. And if you don't mind, Kay, I'd like to dedicate this one to my husband because it's our anniversary today. So sending this out to Connor. He's a huge Puccini fan.
Yes, and you're both musical people, isn't
yes,
that right?
Yes, we are. Connor has been my vocal coach for many, many years now.
Right.
He's a wonderful teacher.
Okay, let's play that. There, un bel di vedremo.
Vedremo. Vedremo. Yeah.
Yes, by Maria Callas, yes. There from Madame Butterfly. Sandra, your husband, Conor Farren, and did you meet through music?
Yes, we did, I guess, because we met at the 30th birthday of a mutual friend who was a soprano as well. And he and she had the same singing teacher. So he knew me to see from blessed Feshkill. I didn't know him. And so he sat in beside me and we started talking. And he actually had tickets to Dmitry Vorostovsky. He had just won the Cardiff Singer of the World and was coming to Ireland. And so he invited me to go with him to see that. So I was thrilled, obviously. So that's how it all started.
How fantastic. And yes. You've had this musical career together, which must
yes,
be great
have.
When people of a similar, disposition, share a life together.
That's right. Absolutely. Yes. And as I said, he's been a wonderful guide and a wonderful support.
Now, Loch Crew Opera Gala is taking place at Loch Crew Estate in Oldcastle in County Meath on Saturday, the 10th of August. Details and tickets are available from lochcrew.com. Thank you so much, Sandra, for coming in.
Okay.